I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers. The Rance Macabre. Cutting,
cultured,
and curated. The term New French Extremity was first used by Art Forum's James Quant. It was meant as a knock to these new horror films that were showing at art venues such as Cannes, and oftentimes leaving the audience booing or even walking out. As we learned in our Grand Guignol episode, the French have always had a unique relationship with horror. We can easily look at the Marquis de Sade for a link between sex and violence. I think, however, post-Guignol heyday playwright Antonin Artaud, although he was speaking of his style, the theater of cruelty, wrote the best of this French horror dynamic. The theater of cruelty has been created in order to restore to the theater a passionate and convulsive conception of life, and it is in this sense of violent rigor and extreme condensation of scenic elements that the cruelty on which it is based must be understood. This cruelty, which will be bloody when necessary but not systematically so, can thus be identified with a kind of severe moral purity, which is not afraid to pay life the price it must be paid. This newer resurgence of French artists creating horror, however, we can assume came about with the rise of conservatism in French politics around the 2000s and has been growing since. This new French extremity has become such an influential genre that the U.S. has seen its fair share of remakes, recently the 2015 Martyrs and The Strangers, which we talked about 2 weeks ago. These films lend us certain expectations, mostly an up-close and personal glimpse into a brief, violent, brutal, and tragic life. While at the same time breaking these expectations, final girls are not always final, or girls, motives run deep, or sometimes not at all. Although the stories vary and the themes run across the board, most dealing with sex, violence, and mental illness, once you finish one of these films, there's no doubt in your mind that you just watch a film that belongs in this genre. No matter who wins in these films, everyone is a loser. You never finish these and feel great afterward. There's a look and a feel to these films. There's a subdued, honest, and beautiful quality that you get that is coupled with such graphic, extreme violence. There's a reason the French came up with the phrase maison sainte and jolie laid. These films paint beautiful scenes with such ugly violence. Each still is an horrific painting. It's like if Eli Roth's Hostel were paired with honesty and naturalism. But it's not. It's its truly own genre, containing some of my most favorite films. Frontier from 2007 director Pascal Loger suggests that the difference between his films and Hostel is the focus on pain, not torture.
Today we're joined by our expert guests, Jen and Dawn of the Women in Caskets podcast. Welcome back.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for having us on again. Yay.
Yeah, it was a year and a half. It was almost 2 years ago that we spoke about the Alien series. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Is it really?
That's what I said.
Almost 2 years.
Yeah,
ago.
Actually it was, because our podcast hadn't been up for very long.
No, we hadn't. We were still babies. I mean, we're still new.
Well, gosh darn it. How did it take a year and a half for us to get through to do
what?
This again?
Well, because in the meantime, crazy. Like, I had made you watch a terrible movie, and then you guys, like, hated me for a while.
Yeah, well, there was that.
Okay, so we'll explain later. But, okay, so we're also joined by the woman who literally wrote the book on New French Extremity, Alex West. Thank you for joining us, Alex.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for asking me.
It's our pleasure, of course. So we figured we'd do a sort of casual Q&A and ask some questions and sort of compare notes on the genre. So I kind of popped this idea as a surprise to the Women in Caskets only a couple days ago. I wanted it to be almost like a Jerry Springer moment. It's like, oh, and here she comes from behind the curtain. But so I opted to give them a little heads up so they could write some questions and sort of figure what they wanted to know more about and just sort of share thoughts and compare notes.
And then after Alex leaves us, then we will go on to explore our two films that the four of us talked about together.
Yeah. So I've got a list of stuff, but I don't want to hog the question time. Does anybody have any initial curiosities or want to?
What I kind of wanted to know, Alex, I know that French Extremity really comes about as kind of a backlash to the conservative political movements in France around 2000. Do you think it was before that, or especially because in America we're experiencing a real conservative movement here? So I was just kind of, you know, curious what we can expect here in America.
Well, I think you guys kind of already had your North American version of New French Extremity in the torture porn movement. And that was, of course, out of a lot of the fear and panic that followed September 11th. So you kind of already had one round of it with George Bush, the second one. And I've been getting asked this question a lot, like, what will horror be under Trump? And I think a lot of people were asking me every so often because of this book. And I feel like now, I don't know if we'll see it again in this iteration. I know there's the new film Raw, but I feel like that'll be kind of a one-off almost. I think if anything, horror will probably get more experimental and more existential and maybe a bit more kind of emotional and sensory over a kind of tactile physical violence, because previously after 9/11, there was a lot of stuff happening behind closed doors, you know, like Guantanamo Bay. And so this was this kind of curiosity and need to see violence and what is hidden behind these choices that people make. And I think now that you have a president who tweets everything he thinks, there's not going to be a lot of secrets and there's not going to be a lot of surprises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was surprised. Yeah. Alex, in the appendix of your book, you have an interview with Colin Geddes, and he talks about how these movies are seen over in France. And I was pretty shocked to find, like, at Cannes, you can usually expect that there's going to be loud booing and whatnot. But even in France, they think of these movies as very American.
Yeah. Well, I always kind of think of New French Extremity as divided into two sections. There's the art house movement, where you have people like Gaspar Noé and his films, Irreversible, I Stand Alone, and Catherine Brûlé and Bruno Dumont. And, you know, these kind of like really art house auteurs. These are these directors who've kind of dabbled in violence and gone on to have other careers, and some stayed, some left. And then you have the horror section, which really kind of kicks off in a meaningful way with Alex Aja's High Tension. And the horror section in particular, like, France doesn't have a true history of horror films the way we know in America or in Canada and North America. So that's something to consider. And that was something I really had to wrap my head around when I was researching and developing the book, was that, you know, they don't have a group of slasher films that you kind of grow up with. They don't, they have the American versions, but there's not an intrinsically French version of that. I mean, the closest you might get are the films of Jean Rollin or Eyes Without a Face. Mm-hmm. So, but they're more fantastique films. They're more about a fantasy that is horrific rather than a horror film, pure and simple.
So is New French Extreme their first, like, French horror genre?
You know, I'd say it's one of their first horror movements proper. The thing is, a lot of these films didn't really play in France, which Colin and I talked about briefly. They were mainly bought up by buyers at the Cannes Festival and then distributed via smaller subsidiaries, studios, and companies like Dimension Extreme, which is Dimension who made all the Scream films. But now they have this Extreme label where they kind of dump all these really, sometimes really great, sometimes really awful films.
Yeah, and you do get a mix.
Yeah. So they've kind of made the rounds via, you know, a direct-to-DVD or a VOD kind of release, but they find a lot of passion behind the festival circuit that you can do with a film. And I think for me, when I was talking to Colin, and I'm very lucky that I live in Toronto and I get, you know, year-round access to TIFF, and, you know, it really confirmed for me how important the festival circuit is for young filmmakers or new filmmakers, because, you know, there's a way, if you make a good film and people respond to it, it can get seen and you can move up a ladder really quickly. So yeah, I think New French Extremity is a great example of utilizing that system.
Yeah, because this is Dawn, and that's how I got interested in the New French Extremity, because they started showing those films at Fantastic Fest.
Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. The festival circuits. I mean, I saw High Tension before I saw Inside.
Yeah, me too.
But I did see Inside at a festival because of you.
She's pointing at me.
But I love that movie. I do. I love that movie intensely. But I say frustratingly to Dawn, because she basically was like, you need to go see this. And I'm like, oh, okay. Were you going to come watch it with me? She's like, no. And I was like, well, is it good? Yeah.
But I don't want to watch it again.
Why don't you want to come see it again? She's like, I can't, but you need to go see it. It's like, what the? And it, yeah.
There's an exhausting dynamic to a lot of these movies.
Not always rewatchable, except for, you know, Calvaire. Right. Calvaire is one of those I could watch over and over and over again because I think it's such a perfect film.
That's so strange. Okay. I mean,
Alex West, what is your expert opinion on Calvaire?
Well, they did an episode on the Faculty of Horror.
I think Calvaire is amazing. I have said this before, and I just to reiterate, I love all of these films, like all of these films in this book. I have a really, really strong affinity for in completely different ways. But I understand never wanting to see most of them ever again. And I was watching these films, you know, three times, four times, often in the span of a week or a week and a half. So, you know, to prep to write about them. And I'm really excited that I will not have to see Irreversible for a really long time, and not because I don't love that movie and not because I don't think it's important and vital and interesting, but because emotionally, like, I can't do it. Yeah. The other one that really, that truly destroyed me, and I knew the ending, going into it, but it absolutely devastated me, was the Bruno Dumont film 29 Palms. And that's more of the art house side. So a lot of horror fans don't necessarily know about it, but it devastated me. I watched it and hadn't seen it before I started writing this book. So I had to watch it a few times in a short span of time. The first time I watched it, I think I just like sat quietly for a really long time because it made a really strong impact on me, more so than any other film I can remember.
You did mention some female filmmakers in this genre. Women in the new French Extreme seem a little rare. I don't know that I've seen any particular. I was sort of looking at the list. I don't think I've seen a new French Extreme film by a woman filmmaker. So I was going to ask you, as far as like women's place in the movement, do you see a reason?
There's actually quite a lot of female film directors, again, okay, when I refer to the art house side. Okay. So not post Alex Aja, that you get a lot of male filmmakers. I think they're all male filmmakers. I think they're almost all white male filmmakers, yeah, off the top of my head. And, but there's some incredible films directed by women. I mean, probably, and I'm so embarrassed because I actually don't have my book in front of me, so I can't look up their names. But two women directed Baise-moi. I believe it was Catherine Brûlée who directed Romance. That's an incredible film. And I mean, the one you kind of all have to see if you really want to talk about New French Extremity is Claire Denis' Trouble Every Day, which is actually the cover of my book.
Right. Yeah. It makes for interesting commuting visuals when I'm on the train reading. That's exciting. I'm curious to check out some of those that you mentioned, especially to contrast, because my knee-jerk reaction when watching something like Inside, I was made pretty uncomfortable by, like, my knee-jerk reaction is like, well, that was a movie about kicking the shit out of another lady. And, you know, there's a baby crazy component if you want to look at it that way. And so I was left, like, really uncomfortable, and I kind of had to resolve it for myself and sort of watch it a second time. And
And then you tried to explain to me how, like, as a lady, I shouldn't like it. Remember that? And
did
I was
do
like,
that?
I like, yeah. And I was like, I think I'll be the judge of that, Darren.
Okay. Apparently.
Are you telling me that Darren tried to mansplain a horror movie to you?
Holy shit.
Now we're beating up on Darren. Yeah, you go, this is misogynistic and here's why. And I was like, I'll be the judge of that.
Go to the corner. Go to the corner.
It's so rare in horror that we like outrage Darren, because it's usually all guys and then me hanging out.
Yeah, yeah. That's, yeah. Who are we kidding? I was arm candy this whole time anyway.
Oh, man.
So I've got a question for Alex, if she doesn't mind.
Sure.
What is it about like the New French Extremity that really just made you want to write this book? Because it's a really interesting and fascinating topic, and it's one I think that especially American cinema doesn't talk enough about. And what was it that pulled you in and made you think, yes, this is what I want to write my book about?
Because I couldn't come up with a simple definition for it, because I talked to people in the horror community here in Toronto and in Canada, and no one really could either. There was a lot of dancing around stuff. There's a lot of great articles, even some other, you know, great, more general books about the movement. They're really in particular focused on more of the art house section. They don't go into the horror section. And I was searching for a lot of answers to a lot of questions I had about the genre and why it made me feel like this. And when I get scared, when I get confused, I try to rationalize everything. And so I was sitting down and making notes, and I was writing articles, and I kept kind of coming back to the subject. And I'd been joking about it for a long time with my dear friend and the co-host of the podcast I do, Andrea Subisati, because she wrote a book. And I was like, oh, I can't be the only one on this podcast that hasn't written a book. And so then I sat down and I actually started to write it. And it was a really enjoyable process. And yeah, it was heady. It was long. It was hard, but it was something that was kind of very satisfying in the end. And I think the only way you can find something that gives you all of those feelings is when you have such great content that these films provide. Mm-hmm. And if the films aren't interesting, and if there isn't like actual stuff going on there, not just narrative, not just plotting events that happen in a film, but real understanding of the world around you and saying those things out loud that no one has said before. I mean, that's what, you know, really, frankly, turns me on as a film critic. And so that felt very natural once I wrapped my head around the idea that I'm going to write a book. It came kind of naturally.
Very cool.
I have a question for you. This is Jen. So I kind of piggybacking on the question previous about the female directors in the French extremist genre, and I was curious if you had seen Julia Ducournau's Raw yet, and how you feel about whether or not where that or if that falls into the genre.
You know, I haven't. I had tickets to see it at TIFF this year, and I came down with the worst flu I've had in a very long time the night.
Oh, no.
And when they screen horror films at TIFF, initially it's part of the Midnight Madness program, and there was no way I was getting out of my bed for like a midnight screening. So I missed it. I'm hopeful. It's getting such good press. I would assume it's going on VOD soon.
It's absolutely incredible. It's my second favorite film of the year. Like,
yeah, I've heard incredible.
And I think a really important feminist film as well. And it's really strong. It's really fucked up, but in a really enjoyable way. And that it's this, it's, I feel like it's, maybe that's what might keep it from being extremists, or at least in line with something like Martyrs or whatnot, because Raw is
punishing
kind of
enough.
Gleeful. Like, Raw is gleeful, if that sounds fucked up, which it kind of does. But I think if you're in the horror, and especially if you're a woman, you'll get something very extra special out of Raw. Because, like, every woman I know that saw that movie that loves horror during Fantastic Fest, all of us were just like, oh, yes, that scratched and itched. We didn't realize we needed scratched so badly. It's really stunning.
The other film I saw kind of over the holidays recently was the new Paul Verhoeven movie, Elle. And that one I've been turning over in my head. It's a French-Belgium co-production, but it's set in Paris. And that's what I've been turning over in my head about. I don't think it really is, but I think if I were starting to write this book now, or I was, you know, still writing it, I might throw it in there. And I definitely would want to mention Raw as well. But definitely, if anyone out there, if you guys haven't seen Elle, it's quite the film.
Yeah.
We I have honestly very, very strong feelings about Elle, and that I hate it deeply.
Oh, cool.
I think it's a very beautiful movie, and I obviously it is well made. It's beautifully acted. Hubert kills it. But I have a huge problem with the story, and especially that it's directed by a man. And I just, the longer I've thought about that movie, the more it's bothered me. It's weird. Like, the more, like, at first I was like, oh, okay, this is kind of bothersome, but all right. And then the more and more I thought about it, the more I was like, I hate this movie. And I hate that everyone that came out of it when I was at Fantastic Fest, or a lot of people were like, wow, that was such a funny movie about rape. And it just made me want to be like, yes. I want to punch you in the face. That is not what that movie was supposed to be. It's just very frustrating hearing a lot of men just like, oh, yeah, it's a real different movie about rape. Just hearing them so casually talk about it, it's just, I don't know. It really incensed something in me.
I think there's something, though, with these films that you never come away being like, eh, it was okay. Like, you really hate them, or you really like love them.
It's the booing and the standing ovation.
Yeah, it encourages a lot of visceral reaction.
Yes.
You know, I was going to say to Alex's point earlier, like, even the bad ones or the lesser entries, as you might say, still leave you with something to consider.
Yeah, even if you hate it, you're still thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah, days, weeks after. Yeah, and I it was in my notes later. I guess I was talking about Martyrs specifically, but and Martyrs is one of the rare instances where they have Americanized this movie for American markets, although that seemed to fall flat. But the idea that when these movies are attempted poorly, they come off as pretty generic torture porn.
And yeah.
There does, you know, there is this extra depth required for it to sort of become something else, become more.
And I think for a lot of it, it comes to the point that when you're looking at the French extremity horror, a lot of the violence and a lot of the horror that's in it, yes, it's a literal torture scene, but it's also metaphorical for a lot of things. There's right. definitely, you know, when we talk about Martyrs and High Tension, there's definitely some serious exploration of the externalization of internal demons going on with those films. And you see a lot of that. Ma Mère, I was thinking about earlier when we were talking about doing this. The use of sex as violence in Ma Mère and a lot of the French Extremity too is taking like internal sexual dysfunction and expressing it outwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think, I mean, that can though really be attributed, especially French is Marquis de Sade, sex, violence, and deviance all going hand in hand.
Mm. Actually, on the note of Martyrs, Alex, on the Faculty of Horror episode where you covered Martyrs and Calvaire, you mentioned that in the American version, there is a moment of physical comedy that is one of your all-time favorite comedic moments, and that it, by the sounds of it, it wasn't on purpose. I was curious if you would give us that story of what the moment is.
I can. I will just say this kind of spoils the remake ending because it happens at the end.
Oh, really? At the very end, they break the mood that badly?
For me, it did. I watched it with my co-host Andrea at her place because she had a screener of it. And I just remember, like, I lost it. I just couldn't stop laughing. I think I made her rewind it.
What did they do? Slip in the blood?
Oh, God, I wish. I can tell you outright, and any listeners who don't want to hear it can, like, skip ahead 30 or 45 seconds.
Okay, yes. Spoiler warning.
Okay, spoiler warning for the end of the Martyrs remake, and which also kind of spoils the end of the original Martyrs. So Martyrs remake, obviously in the original, when the film ends and the guy's like, Mademoiselle, what did she say? And she's like, keep doubting. And she shoots herself in the head, and that's the end. And we get this kind of bleak, morose ending. And in this one, they torture one of the girls in the remake, and she's kind of murmuring towards the end. And the other girl, who is not dead, bursts in and is like, oh, I'm going to get my friend. And it's insane. And then then someone stands up from the cult and is like, what did that girl say? Did she see the other side? And Kate Burton, who is playing the Mademoiselle, says, no, I didn't hear. And then a guy, like, and she's in the front of the, she's at the front of the frame, right, the center. And a guy pops up behind her, who is like one of her lackeys, and says, oh, I did. And then shoots himself in the head and falls over. It was like Monty Python. I couldn't. Like,
that's hilarious.
So, and then like the movie just kind of like goes on. It's so fucking bananas because there's so many people still alive and everyone's like running around. It is like, I think the closest thing, you know, I could say about it to New French Extremity is that it really encapsulates that kind of French farce aesthetic, But it was...
Oh, my Lord.
Wow. Way to miss the point remake.
Wow. Oh, that sounds horrifically bad.
That's like, so I've said to people, if you're really curious about the remake, definitely watch it because it's so different from the film while still aping on a lot of the stuff that they thought was like cool or like super deep. and it actually, interestingly, it entirely misses the point, as you guys have already kind of deduced. And so from that vantage point, yeah, it's totally interesting. I think it's like 80 minutes. And it's actually interesting how the choices they make that change it.
Sounds like a very American thing to like just be this non-committal, let's try and weasel our way to a happy ending.
Because then you can't be blamed. Of course. It's to avoid blame.
Oh, God. Yeah. But holy shit.
Yeah, American versions and American remakes, like, period, love, like, making everything happier. Like, taking a perfectly good horror movie that has an awful ending but means something and is interesting or different. And then, like, oh, we're going to redo it. But let's make sure this person lives and because that's too sad. And let's change this. Like, when I heard about the, and I never saw it, but when I heard about the Last House on the Left remake, and then I read about it, and I was like, what? That's a completely different movie.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah, that is.
They love, the American movies love fucking shit up. They just don't, they refuse to believe that their audience can handle real life. Even, it's like, it's already a horror movie, dude. Like, just let it, oh my God. Or also don't remake it. Like, I just also hate remakes. Like 90% of the time they're absolutely horrible. Sometimes it works, but often it is kind of pointless.
Yeah, Alex, who were the team who did the American version of The Hills Have Eyes? Well, sorry, the remake of The Hills Have Eyes.
Oh, that was Alex Aja.
Okay, yeah. So high tension? That's yeah. Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he also did the Piranha 3D remake, and he was a producer on the Maniac remake.
I was going to say that his Hills Have Eyes remake was not bad.
Yeah, and I will say that all the ones you've mentioned, I have not much of an issue with any of those. I kind of enjoyed Piranha 3D for how stupid it was.
Yeah. I like and that then, Hills Have Eyes. Those monsters are excellent.
Yeah, and Hills Have Eyes is good. And Maniac. That was great.
Yeah.
I really liked the Maniac remake.
Yeah, well, and that's because that's Alex. His roots are in the New French Extremity.
Exactly.
And he's one of the few directors that has had any success translating that.
Yeah.
That's to true. A point where it can be palatable to American production studios.
Exactly.
Great. Alex, thank you so much for joining us. Please give your plugs. We'll put the book and the link in our show notes, and we'll talk it up the week it's out and on and on. I reference it quite a bit actually in the show, but please, your plugs.
So beyond my book, you can hear more of me if you're not already sick of podcasts or have room for more on the Faculty of Horror podcast, and you can find us at facultyofhorror.com and on iTunes and I think every format that we can possibly be on, because oh my God, how could we not have another format? I'm on Twitter at ScareAlex if you want to follow me, and I post any of the writing I do up there.
Great. So thanks again, and we hope to have a reason to get you on again.
Because I want to watch some more movies where I feel like crap and then have Alex on.
Well, before the recording, we talked about your next project being
I can handle that.
90s horror. And that's something to look forward to.
Yeah, those movies are a lot easier to watch. A lot easier.
Okay, so on our side with Jen and Dawn from Women in Caskets, we're going to start off with High Tension, or Switchblade Romance was an early title.
I kind of like that title. It's sexier that way.
I thought Switchblade Romance is both confusing and a little bit of a spoiler to the movie. I don't know how it's a big spoiler.
Wait, High Tension?
Switchblade Romance.
Oh, Switchblade. Yes. Oh. Yes. That's a huge spoiler. And it sounds like a weird, like, cheap, like a paperback, like novel, or those like cheap, like romance.
Yeah, books. I like it. I think it's sexy.
Like a 1930s pulp novel.
Yeah.
I guess because it debuted at TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival, it sounds like it might have gone under a couple names before they settled on High Tension. Directed by Alexander Aja and written by Aja and his collaborator Gregory Levasseur, who, judging by the behind-the-scenes stuff, he also seems to do like co-directing. It seems like he's constantly there. Together, we talked about it before, but they were the couple that did the remake of The Hills Have Eyes, which I thought was a pretty solid flick, like pretty daring considering the subject matter and how the original is, you know, people, I think, fetishize early Wes Craven stuff. Okay, so here is the beginning of our spoilers in the synopsis, and we'll start diving in a moment. Alexia travels with her friend Marie to spend a couple days with her family in their farm in the country. They arrive late and are welcomed by Alexia's father. Late at night, a sadistic killer breaks into the farmhouse, slaughters Alexia's family, and kidnaps her. What follows is a brutal cat-and-mouse game between a desperate Marie and the vicious maniac.
Okay, I'm just going to jump in. I know Dawn does not like this movie. But I'm going to tell you I like it so much that I can't even deal with it.
Dawn, get ready, because I think Mindy's going to mansplain to you
now. There's no mansplaining. This is why you should like it. You know what? I'll tell you the reason I like it. I love, obviously, the extreme violence, and there's clearly violent things that I've never seen before, and that's what I'm always looking for. The head in the stairs is one of my favorite things I've ever seen. I think it's so ingenious, you know?
Not me. I was a kid who got his head stuck in a lot of things.
Actually, Darren's father tells a story of Darren being in Puerto Rico getting his head stuck in a fence.
Yeah, so I don't think it's so thrilling when I see the same thing happen in a horror movie, because that was my nightmare. But okay, moving on.
No, but I'll tell you, I like it so much because I think Cecil de France is like the sexiest lady alive. And I just, that's all I think of when I watch this movie. And I'm like, I don't know, it's like an hour and a half of me watching sexy lady run around. I don't care.
Yeah, she's really fucking hot.
Yeah, right?
And Mindy, I will give you that it is a technically brilliant film. Like there's some really excellent scenes throughout this film. My problem is the whole spoiler at the end.
Okay. I get that
retroactively kills the entire movie for me. Like even watching it again going into this, I'm like, yes, that's a really, like, you're right. That scene on the banister on the stairs with his head through, and
it's crazy.
That's awesome. The moment where she pulls out the post and she's wrapping the barbed wire around it like she's fucking Negan.
Oh, when she's she's driving to that Muse song, it's fucking awesome too, right?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And
fucking moment kind of bothers me though. Like, I have to say, because I really, really like that movie. I do. I have a few issues with it. But that fucking Muse song.
I love it. Muse. Oh, I love Muse. Get off my show.
It just feels so out of place to me.
I love it. I think it's like a great moment.
I mean, it's a music video at that point. Yeah. She's just,
so weird.
On a mission.
Yeah, but the ending kills me, and it kills me every time because it doesn't cheapen everything that came before. It's just so damn cliche. It just really put a bad taste in my mouth. And so ever since then, I can't watch that movie without thinking about how much the ending pisses me off.
So I'm with you there. It's incredibly frustrating that the cliche of multiple personalities gets put to use in this movie that, like, I don't know. I feel like there's a version of this that didn't really need it, but that said, it makes for an interesting rewatch when you watch Marie and is it Lily? No, what's
Alex?
Her? Alex?
Yeah.
When you watch them the second time around, you pick up on an element where, like, she's not happy to see her. Like, it's messy.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Cecile de France. Sorry, I'm saying it wrong. Is
Do
it
whatever
Cecile?
You want.
Cecile de France? I don't know. Okay, so we talked about her.
The star of the show.
But Mei Wen is an actress who they talk about having found her at a comedy show. I don't know that she was performing, but she had been in a bunch of like short movies. But she's eventually the actress who plays the diva in The Fifth Element.
Yes,
she's
not the Blue voice, Lady. Though. She's
right,
not
right.
the voice.
She's not the opera singer. But I thought Laguna? That... Sorry?
Plava Laguna, is that the name you were looking for a moment ago?
Yeah, Plava the Laguna. Yeah, the blue opera singer from The Fifth Element. Yeah, okay. And so Philip Nahon plays our aggressor, and he's also in Calvert.
Yeah, he's one of the farm
townspeople.
Yeah.
Yeah, that guy's horrifying.
Yeah, in Calvert, he really is.
Yes.
That's another film I love.
Yeah, so early on in the movie, I do, upon second viewing, I still feel the same way as Dawn does to an extent, and I kind of like the movie despite its faults, and we'll start talking about that, but I do really like the dynamic of this unreliable narrator that we're pretty early introduced to. I keep forgetting, is it Marie?
Yeah, why can't you remember this?
Marie. And that she's had the dream that could have been what we just saw in the opening credits, and that she's kind of acknowledging it, but you're not sure where we're going from there. I don't know. I think I missed a lot on the first viewing, and because of that, I think even more frustrated by the ending.
And that is Maywin's head that we see in the very beginning,
as well.
Yeah. So because it's like only one person in France probably has those bangs, just like that. You know, it's her. Because my husband turned to me, he's like, "Wait, that's the lady from." Because we were rewatching it like a couple nights ago, and I was like, "Yeah, it is." He's like, "I wouldn't have known if it wasn't for the bangs." So I was like, "Yeah, good thing they're there, honey. Good job."
I thought she has a gap in her teeth that I thought I didn't see in the severed head. I don't know. This is how closely I'm watching it.
I am also going to do another spoiler because it's been my thing. Spoiler alert, the dog dies in this one. But it's not like that sad because it's off camera and it doesn't make me feel that sad.
Yeah, they don't enhance it with sound effects.
This is a new thing I'm doing, guys. I'm like telling when the dogs die in films because I'm sick of being surprised by this shit.
Oh, you would probably not enjoy Fantastic Fest because there are certain years where we keep a running tally of the number of dogs that are killed during the festival.
No need. Let the dog run free.
It's really, yeah. It's
but kill the human.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's fine.
Yeah, it's like a shorthand for making a villain really horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
so
man.
As far as like early critiques, the first half of the movie... has English dubbing. Like, there doesn't seem to exist a version that is only the French. And you're looking at me funny. Like, that's
because,
not the case.
Because there was at one time. The first time I saw this movie, it was entirely in French.
Exactly. Yeah. Me too. And then I went to rewatch it, and I couldn't find it without this weird overdubbing at the beginning. And then they forget about it halfway through, and then they're speaking French again.
Right. Well, they kind of explain that she didn't grow up there. Her family are new. Their French is as bad as yours, Marie. Like, it's
right because Marie's Belgian, really. So I think that's why they give her that weird French accent in the overdubbing.
Marie, remember, my family just moved here 6 months ago. Your French is worse than mine. Here we are.
So Maywin speaks, you know, like regular English American. Dialect, and then Marie has this kind of funny accent. I think it's because she's Belgian.
Okay, yeah, I felt like I was watching a Dario Argento movie. It was weird.
Yeah, no, there was originally a version that I watched with none of that shit.
I think I would prefer that. It felt like whatever filter the translations went into dumbed it down pretty bad.
Oh, yeah. It's super awkward.
Yeah, I hate overdubbing always. I'd rather just watch it even in... Because like Martyrs, when I rewatched it today, I just watched it in French. I didn't need to really know exactly what was going on.
Oh, you didn't even use the subtitles?
Not this time. I mean, like previously when I watched it the first time, yeah,
okay,
I did.
But
today,
it.
No, when I was watching it at lunch, no, I just did it in French. It's fine. There's a few things though. I love the kills. Loving the kills in this film. But... There's one point where someone hides under a bed, and we know, because I've tried to fit under the bed, that you can't. And I get really mad now when anyone successfully gets their ass under a bed.
For you, it's a plot hole.
It is. Then I know. I'm like, this isn't real.
Oh, you and your home invasion issues, Minnie. It's just...
I really thought I could fit under
a
bed.
I can fit under my bed.
Is this true? Have you tried it?
Yes.
How tall is your bed?
I have just one of those, you know,
it's a
like
loft bed.
Things that you rise, you rise the bed or whatever.
I don't know.
Okay. The frame.
Well, but I can't fit under mine. I really thought I could.
It depends on the make and model of your frame, because I've had beds where I could fit under and I've had beds where I couldn't.
Yeah. I guess that's true. I've had beds where I couldn't fit under as well.
And I will say that the older the bed, the greater the chances are that it's higher, especially in American furniture.
Oh, yeah, because my grandmother's bed was super high and I used to be able to crawl under that all the time. She had one of the four poster beds.
Okay. Oh, I'm just trying to crawl under the wrong beds.
Yeah, that's your problem. Your home is just not optimized for home invasions.
I can't fit in the cabinet. I can't fit under the bed. What am I going to do?
You need to move.
It's for your own safety. You need to move.
No, you need to move. You just need to go to IKEA and be like, all right, show me the beds that I can crawl under.
I'll be on the floor in IKEA trying to get under the bed. I bet they would humor you. No one would say shit at IKEA if you're trying to climb under the bed.
No, people film entire shows at IKEA.
And they sleep on the beds and stuff.
They've seen some, there's been some much crazier
shit.
It's
IKEA, they've seen
some shit. Yeah, exactly. Oh my God, I've seen some shit at IKEA and I've only been like a handful of times, so.
Mindy, you mentioned some of the kills in this are savage in a way that I mean, we must have seen savagery like this in other movies, but there's something about, there's a visceral nature to these that's really disturbing. Yeah.
There's also a certain amount of cutting away in these. I noticed that when I was rewatching, and especially the scene where she's hiding in the closet while the mother's being killed.
Yeah.
And you actually, aside from the blood spray and a couple of quick gore shots, you don't see a lot of it. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so effective. You could tell that if, like, say, an Eli Roth got his hands on it, the camera would be right in the neck as the knife was going across.
Yeah. Now, there are, though, two different versions of this film.
Okay.
And it's sad, but you're almost giving Aja too much credit, because he did cut from that scene in particular where he cuts the mom's throat. There's a scene where Philippe pulls the head back and opens up that neck wound a little bit more. And so the quick cutting isn't always in there. So that's kind of like, dang. But I still like it.
But still, even with that, because the version that I saw had that in it where, you know, he pulls the head back and you see the wound in the neck gap. But even then, a lot of the blood spray and everything is happening because you're more tight on Marie's face.
Yeah, I love that blood painting the white doors. It's like one of my favorite things. So it's beautiful.
Yeah, and then the
eye contact.
In the car. Well, I was thinking later on in the car where literally it appears as if a red gel was put over the camera lens is how much blood hits it. And that one, it turns out, was an accident. Like, they did not plan to soak the camera in blood.
And Maiwen is sitting in the backseat, getting sprayed with blood, screaming like a maniac. Then she stops for a second because she literally has too much blood in her mouth.
She's choking on the blood.
And I was just like, damn, that's acting like at its best. And then she goes back to screaming like a maniac.
I remember laughing at that. I remember thinking that I shouldn't be laughing in this moment, but I was laughing because she literally had to stop, spit out blood, and continue screaming.
I love it.
Yeah. Going back to the closet scene, when Marie does come out and, like, is seeing if there's anything she can do, she picks up the mother's hand and reveals that he just, like, arbitrarily cut that off and probably took it with him.
Yeah, why not?
And it's one of these things that happens off camera. I didn't notice that there was a sound effect or anything that matched it. And so it is just this it's another moment of what the fuck, why?
Right. Because we see the body again, too. So we're always going back to these bodies. You see the initial kill. Then we go back and re-examine every single body.
Yeah.
And that's really gruesome the second time around. Even in the edited version where we don't see the head come clean off of the banister scene. The dog just dropped the bottle. We do come back, though, and see that body without the head. So even if we didn't see it come off, which we do in the full version, but, like, you still know that head is gone and that's just that body sitting there. So I love that about this film.
Yeah, and it's the same thing with the little brother, too.
Yeah.
Because you see the chase through the corn as he's trying to escape, and you hear the gunshots, but you don't actually see the body, I think, until he's pulling away with Alex and Marie in the back, and you do this one final tour through the house.
Right. I love the revisiting of it. It's just like that much more brutal.
Yeah. I think it's in that same moment where we see the car, the truck pull away, and we get this, like, you know, under any other circumstance, it would be a gorgeous landscape of, you know, cornfields and sky. And then he does give us an aerial view of the little brother, you know, sort of facing
down. Yeah, just right off the side of the road.
Ugh.
Yeah. Like, it was, moments like that are fucking haunting.
Yeah, just in case you thought that he missed him. You know, it was like, just so y'all know, this is for real. Right.
Removing any doubt of optimism.
Just in case you had any hope for the future, we're just going to dash that right off. And
although they still, I mean, considering how fucked up all of the deaths and torture and whatnot in this movie, I mean, they definitely still, for some reason, felt the need to hold back on the kid, because they were like, let's just do a gunshot in a cornfield. Like, you know what I mean? It's like the only one. Right. They all yelled at him. It's the only one they didn't, like, do any close-up carnage on.
It's true. They spared him and the dog for the most part.
Him and the dog.
Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah. Always kids and the dog. People are always so scared of fucking up kids and dogs on camera. Do whatever you want to women and men. Have fun.
Until the movie Cub.
Until Cub. And there's some other movies that and I really like them. That's why I liked Safe Neighborhood. Because the fucking up the kids is definitely don't have a problem with that in that movie.
Okay. Even I guess in Martyrs, they're older, but still Martyrs is I mean, the conflict is within the character, but as far as demonstrating horrible violence on children, they're not pulling a single punch.
Ooh, boy.
Yeah, Martyrs doesn't pull any punches on anything, but we're still talking about High Tension, so.
So I was surprised. This was in the IMDb trivia section, but IMDb straight up accuses the screenwriters of plagiarism because of Dean Koontz's book Intensity. Now, they share components as far as, like, two girls going to one of their childhood homes, and a killer shows up to do some work, and that's it. But I don't know. I guess Dean Koontz has sort of acknowledged it but not gone after them legally. I don't know. It seems like it's own story, clearly. And from what I understand, Dean Koontz's book doesn't affect anything about split personalities or sort of change-ups that way. But yeah, I don't know. Even still, I was surprised.
That's ridiculous. I mean, a story where it starts out where two girls go out to some place, like, really? Come on. Like, that's not what makes this movie special.
Yeah.
Everyone knows it's Cecil de France.
Upon the second viewing, watching Marie's exchange, once she arrives at the gas station and she... I guess it's after the attendant. She's on the phone with their version of 911. Mm-hmm. There was a part of me that was like kind of heartbroken that 911 in the south of France is just as shitty as it is here as far as like not knowing where anybody is.
Yeah, but also for me, when the first time watching this movie, not now, but I remember the first time I saw this movie, because I really liked it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, good.
And... I remember the first time I saw this movie, and that scene was when I started going, there's something's wrong. Something's not right about this. Like, yeah. I felt like you could find the address. Like, she really wasn't looking at the papers. Like, that whole scene, instead of like revealing like her just being too flustered, like kind of revealed to me like, no, she's actively trying to not tell him the address unintentionally somehow. That's weird.
And here's the thing is that I was already suspicious at this point because of the fact that she'd made it out of the truck to begin with.
Right, exactly.
Because when he's locking Alex, and of course Bree, who's hiding inside in the back of the truck, you see him very clearly putting a fairly sturdy padlock on the back of the truck from the outside.
That's true.
And yet, here she is, able to get out of the back to go in here. And plus the reactions of the attendant. The first time I saw this movie, this is when I started going, oh, they're going to do what I think they're going to do, and that's going to make me really unhappy. And sure enough, they did what I thought they were going to do, and it made me really unhappy.
This is one of those I watched clear to the end, and I didn't, like, I literally didn't get it until it was revealed to me, and I felt really stupid after. Like, I was just like, son of a bitch, you know?
Well, and I think, and for me, this is just because I'm always, always on the lookout for the killer lesbian trope. Because it's one of my least favorite tropes, and it shows up a lot.
She's boobmatized in the very beginning. Like, when she sees Maiwen naked, that's what starts this whole chain of events.
Yep, exactly.
You think it
and
started?
And I saw that, and I saw her in her room masturbating afterwards, and I was like, okay, so this is sort of weird and creepy and voyeuristic, and I'm not really okay with what this character is doing right now. And then we kept going and kept going and kept going, and there was a viciousness to her and a focus on her friend and a certain disconnect when she was dealing with the deaths of the rest of the family. That I was just like, oh, this is going to be the sexually repressed psycho killer, gay people are crazy trope. And that just, you know, for all of its technical brilliance, for all of those wonderful gore scenes and the really great fight between the man, the captor, air quotes, and Marie, you know, for all of the wonderfulness that there is right there, it's just undercut with this really crappy twist.
Yeah. I can understand that because it is kind of the theme of this film. And I always, my theme that I always hate is she hasn't met the right man yet theme. That's always a theme that you see. And it's like, oh, I'm gay until I haven't met the right man, like a girl with a dragon tattoo or something like that.
Yeah.
So, like, I totally can see that about this film. For some reason, I just didn't let it bother me, and I don't know why. Normally, it would bother me a great deal because it is what starts this chain of events. Because she's looking at the window, she's on the swing, and then suddenly she disappears, and that's when she finally has this like break.
Yep.
I kind of assumed it was building the whole time. I kind of
I think it's one moment, don't you girls, right?
Oh, okay. I have to watch it yet again.
No, because I wrote it down because I wanted to make sure I was right about the sequence, because that's what I thought too. Because she goes to watch Alex shower, she comes back in, she masturbates, and as she's masturbating is when the guy starts driving up to the house.
Right, so I think she never went inside. That's why she's ringing on the doorbell.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
And why the dad lets her in. Because I think, like, when you see that empty swing, I think that's when you, like, that's the break right there.
Ah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also, who masturbates in their friend's house with your headphones on? You could turn the music on in the room, but don't put the headphones on, dummy.
No, because you can't hear yourself.
But everyone else can hear you.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the worst idea. I thought that, too, when I was watching it. But I was like,
put it on in the room.
I agree with both you, Mindy, and you, Don, is the thing. Is like, I agree that it is an issue and it is horribly problematic. But for whatever reason, at the time, I just was like, enjoyed the movie.
That's how I feel.
And now I'm like, well, yes, that is a problematic trope. That really is. But I don't know. I mean, I like it a little less now. But I still like it.
It's okay to like it.
I like it.
I'm not saying you guys are wrong to like it. You guys can like it all you want. It's just not my thing.
No,
you're
totally right about that trope, though.
You are. And I no longer think this is one of the best horror movies. Like, I mean, it's so many. I've seen so many amazing things since then. I just think that this was one of the first art house intense extreme horror movies I'd seen.
Yeah, I think this was probably the first French, I think, extreme film that I ever watched. Maybe Calvin. No, it was this one.
Yeah, I guess this was pretty this early was as far as the American attention. When this played at TIFF, it made a lot of ripples. But actually, going back to the point, I just wanted to sort of ask the question that even though it is playing directly into like the killer lesbian component, but it actually winds up being quite a bit about like toxic masculinity in terms of this character. The words that come out of Marie's mouth as the guy.
Tu m'aimes? Tu m'aimes pas, hein? Tu m'aimes pas, hein? Hein, que tu m'aimes pas? Tu m'aimes pas? Tu m'aimes pas?
Just towards the end, when things are wrapping up, they are
horrible.
Yeah, they're so aggressive, but there are elements that were planted in their conversation earlier in the movie between Alex and Marie. Marie is very quick to like slut shame her, just little
all the time.
Yeah, just mm-hmm. little things, yeah. Practically unprovoked.
I hope at least that he was worth it.
He was. Unbelievable.
Espèce de salope.
Peste.
Menace.
Pétasse.
Mouchage.
You're a pig.
And you, Marie? Are you going to finally take the plunge?
Don't start with that.
You're gonna end up alone.
I'm not a slut like you.
You're so scared.
And that's why I think it, as far as her coveting Alex, I felt that that was established earlier in those scenes.
It was, you know, there's a lot of internalized and externalized misogyny inherent in that character because of the way that, you know, she's talking to Alex about her relationships. And, you know, Alex was saying that, what was she saying? It made me giggle when I first heard it, is that she wasn't interested in men that weren't already with someone because she wanted to know that they were worth it.
Right. With single men, you know, there's a problem is essentially what she's saying.
And that was the thing I had an issue with on rewatch more, that it bothered me, I guess, a little bit the first time I watched it, but I didn't focus on it. But the second time, I'm like, God damn it.
The whole conversation they're having in that kitchen is.
Exactly. I'm like, both of them have horrible, horrible ideas about sex and relationships. And like, they're both fucked up. Like,
yeah, like, I was kind of hoping that was. It came down to like a bad translation before the dub. Like, because some of their language was very childish. And I wasn't, I didn't feel confident that like it was exactly what the filmmaker intended.
I took it as like the beginning of Last House on the Left when the two girls are talking not at all like two women would speak to each other and so I thought like a man wrote this and he doesn't get it, you know, then I just like let it go over my head. I was like, fine, whatever.
yeah I guess so. I guess that was their idea of what women must talk about cheating. I don't know,
and they say slut all the time, whatever.
It bothered me, but I also hate Last House on the Left.
There you go.
It's the one Wes Craven thing I can't stand.
Oh, that intro is terrible with the girls. People do not speak like
God.
That.
Oh, God. Oh, it's horrible. Yeah, it's horrible. I can't watch it.
I don't think anyone should blame you. Yeah.
Jen and I had discussions about Last House on the Left before, but that's neither here nor there.
Ugh.
Because we come down on the opposite side. Like, it's sort of the reverse of how we feel about High Tension, and that Jen can't stand it at all. And I can appreciate it from certain aspects. You know, I still think it's a horrible, horrible piece of trash, but... I can appreciate certain aspects of it.
I can't.
Dawn, can I ask you, have you seen the remake?
No. Fuck no.
Absolutely
Sorry,
not.
Really vulgar, but no.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. That's the point. Like, granted, I didn't like that original movie, but I also think if you're going to do a remake and you change the fact that the girl doesn't die in the beginning, then, like, fuck you. That's the point of the movie. Like, I didn't like the movie, but that was the whole, like... At least that was what made... Because the thing is, there are things in Last House on the Left that I do think are interesting. I just hate the way that movie's filmed. I hate the way the women are exploited sexually. I hate it. But the concept of the actual plot and premise of it is
a great premise for a fucked up horror movie.
Yeah, and it's rooted in, it's a retelling of an old Greek myth.
Exactly.
Which I can sort of appreciate the sort of adding the contemporary for its time aesthetic to that. And
yeah. And I could see that one actually getting a remake done and doing it respectfully and but still doing it well. And then the fact that she fucking survives, I'm like, that actually makes me mad.
That's something that's like really different between, because that is a ultra-violent film, really brutal short life, in which is what I expect in these French films, right? Last House on the Left is very much like that.
Right.
But
yeah,
the
yeah.
goofiness and the silliness, and I think that's what I really hate about it. I hate the fucking goofy parts. I think it's really irritating and I don't think it's funny. And that's one thing in these French extreme movies. There's no silly parts. Nothing is funny.
No, yeah,
you never no. laugh. It's not funny ever. And it's just this really brutal, not at all funny thing, which American horror always has this little edge of humor to it.
Yeah, which more often than not, well, I guess in the bad films, it falls flat on its face.
Right.
And yeah, I think the French are far more streamlined as far as tone.
There's also an economy of storytelling in the fact that they're more content to show things as opposed to having to explain
right.
them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Right. They trust their audience's intelligence more. So
because there's a lot of that in Martyrs, especially mm-hmm. in the second half of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's,
you have to make it up on your own.
There's no yeah. dialogue for like 20, 30 minutes in Martyrs.
Yeah, no, that's why I could watch it in French, no problem, today, yeah. because there really isn't that much. Even with High Tension, when it switches just to be in French, it's, you know, you don't really miss anything.
Yeah, by that point, there's so much momentum in the movie that... It could be in German, like, it doesn't matter. It's not about the dialogue.
Right.
So I wanted to point this out. As far as New French Extremity... Jen, Dawn, have you seen Calvaire?
No, I have not.
It's my most favorite thing.
I'm sorry. I feel like I've let you down, Mindy, but no, I have not seen
you
it.
You have to watch it. Just watch it. It's okay that you haven't seen it. It's just one really to watch.
Okay.
So without giving spoilers, these movies find similar elements towards the end. In Calvaire, the main character, Mark, has ambitions to make it big, to be beloved, but when he becomes... this particular small town's sole focus, their prized possession, and the thing they most covet, it becomes clear that they just wanted to be loved back. And in High Tension, one of those last moments has the killer maniacally demanding love from Alex, like yeah. it's the yeah. only thing that'll set her free, that it's the only way Alex is going to make it out of there is that if she reciprocates his love,
right.
or, well, her love, Marie's love.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of enjoyed that little bit of symmetry, but I hope I didn't give too much away.
Well, there's also a symmetry, you know, if you want to even carry that further into Martyrs, and I realize this is getting ahead a little bit, Lucy's imaginary friend, shall we say, is very much... You know, you hear Lucy telling her, you know, I killed them, I killed them, I killed them. Why won't you leave me alone? And it's the same sort of pleading, the fact that they think that there is a cure-all, you know, for Marie. It's like, if you tell me that you love me, everything's going to be okay. For Lucy, it's if I kill these people, everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great point.
Right.
And that's a good segue. So go ahead.
Yeah.
Oh, no, sorry. And here's another thing that I've always... I'm curious as to what people think about High Tension, or as far as like just other people's opinions, because I know a lot of people have a difference of opinion as far as what is actually wrong with Marie. You keep saying split personalities,
right,
or multiple
really a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So
don't tell M. Night Shyamalan that.
Oh, God, do not see that movie. Or maybe see that movie because the actor's really good in it, but God, it's really bad. It's really bad, but he's amazing. Oh, it's so frustrating. God damn it. It's like, it is, because I want to be like, don't see that movie. It's a horrible piece of trash. But then I'm also like, James McAvoy, holy goddamn, he's amazing in it. It's one of the best performances I've ever seen. but it's also a really terrible movie.
That's like, how I feel about really Magnolia.
Frustrating. Huh?
The film Magnolia. That's how I feel. Everyone's doing a really good job, but I hate it.
That's really funny. Life is a House. Is that really boring one with, never mind. I was forget that one Marissa Tomei was in. She won an Oscar or whatever.
In the bedroom?
Everyone loved it. Huh?
Was it In the Bedroom?
Yes.
I love that film. Wow.
Oh, I hated that movie.
You know what? Literally, I saw it because I wanted to see Nick Stahl. I used to love Nick Stahl. And I watched it. This is a short segue, whatever. It's my show. I'll talk about what I want. God damn it.
We never stay on topic.
But
I was literally watching for Nick Stahl, and it was one of the first films I saw with my husband when we were dating. And I didn't know Nick Stahl was going to die in the first 3 minutes of the film.
Spoiler alert.
It's not a spoiler. It's, I guess, the point of the film, which I didn't know until I went in and saw it. And I was hysterical crying for the entire rest of the film. Hysterical. Because I think Sissy Spacek is amazing.
Wow. I don't know what it was, but I was so bored.
I don't know. I was hysterical. It's really a problem.
Oh my God. That's great. Oh, that's so good.
So we were segueing into Martyrs, right?
So the segue.
I can't think of a better segue into 2009's Martyrs.
No, we're talking about what's wrong with Marie.
Yeah, what is wrong with Marie?
What's wrong with Marie? What is she? So is it
how
a psychotic
break? How do you solve a problem
break?
With Maria?
How do you solve a problem like Maria?
God.
I'm not a musical theater person, but I have a feeling that was a musical theater reference.
Yes, it was. It's a very famous musical theater reference, actually. Yeah. It's one you should actually know. That's a pretty common reference in general. That's just not like a...
I'm going to start
musical
saying
nerdy thing.
How can we explain it to you later?
I don't know what is wrong with it. I just think I don't think it's like a split personality thing. I think she just disassociates a little.
Right. Well, right. Just disassociation. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I was thinking is I just kind of thought it was like a disassociation, like a split from reality, a cognitive just like break.
Because I think she's just like seeing what she maybe even wants to be. You know what I'm saying? Like she wants to be this like hyper masculine asshole guy who just takes what he wants.
Right. Well, because, yeah, she's not idealizing.
I don't think that's what she wants, though. No, I think no. Here's what I think. Her subconscious or psyche or whatever created this villain. This man, this evil person that wants to get at her, because for some reason, Marie convinced herself the only way that she can have Alex, is if she proves herself to her, if she saves her.
To win her.
To win her, exactly. Mm. So she has this break, and in order to become the hero, she creates this problem for her. She creates this bad guy. She creates the villain in order so that she can be the hero. At least that's what I thought.
No, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does. When we watched the Strangers, there was a minute that we doubted, I don't know, Scott Speedman's character, the possibility that he set this up so as to be the hero who swoops in and saves the day and, you know, in that case, gets her to commit to marriage. But, high tension is kind of that. It is this moment. And it's also this, like, heightened, creepy, coveting thing that, like, I will be the only thing in this world that you love because I will kill everything else.
The hero and the only thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's the iteration in one of the final scenes where it's just down to Alex and Marie and the audience now knows what's going on. And yes, it's a horrible dub, but I think it's a relatively decent translation of the phrase that she's using, saying that there's nothing that's going to come between us now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
She's just saying that over and over again. She's got a damn tire iron through her chest, but she's just saying that over and over and over again.
Thank you.
2008's Martyrs, written and directed by Pascal Leger. We see our main two people, Lucy, who in my notes I wrote, Lucy equals crazy, Anna equals friend. Those were my notes there.
Okay, this feels like we're teaching chimps. Okay.
This is how I had to keep everyone straight. Okay. Lucy, played by Maline Champagnoy, and Anna, played by Morjana Alouy.
Okay, so do we? Well, we're going full spoilers on everything, so I'll give a quick synopsis. 15 years after a horrifying experience of abduction and prolonged torture, Lucy embarks on a bloody quest for revenge against her oppressors. Along with her childhood friend Anna, who also suffered abuse, she quickly descends without hope into madness and her own delusions. Anna, left on her own, begins to re-experience Lucy's nightmare when she was only 12 years old. So let's talk first impressions, because this is one that I think you're kind of left to think about after this movie. It took me a while.
Oh, yes, we need Dawn's. She said she had to tell us
story about Dawn going in to see this movie. Dawn went into this movie completely blind. I knew absolutely nothing. I knew it was a French film. It was at Fantastic Fest.
I went into Inside.
Yes. Which is which is how I initially went into Inside too, which is one of the reasons why that's why I put you through it. But I knew nothing about this movie going in. And so the first half of the movie plays very much like that synopsis you just gave. It's one girl's attempt to get revenge on the people who tortured her as a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you hit that point, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, and the entire movie switches. When that started happening, I started sinking further and further and further into my seat until I was almost in a fetal position in the theater watching this movie, because it was so unexpected.
Yeah.
It was not what I was expecting out of the movie at all, because I went to it, I was like, it's just going to be a bloody French horror movie. It's like Inside. Mm-hmm. And that's how I went into it. And then that movie just did that whole 180 on itself.
Yeah.
And it was one of the few movies where when the credits rolled, I could not move. Mm. I sat there just in stunned silence for while the first half of the credits rolled before I was even able to move after seeing this movie. I had tears running down my face. I was just like, I was a mess. I was just a goddamn mess.
That's
coming
so
out
crazy.
Of it. And then I watch it.
Yep.
And then you're like, I saw this movie and it really fucked me up. Here you go. You need to watch it. It's like The Ring. Not actually The Ring, but like the movie they watch in The Ring.
Exactly how Jen and I function is that we see something, we're like, oh my God, that's awful, that's terrible, that's awesome, that's wonderful. You need to see it.
Yep.
Yeah. The exactly. credits roll and exactly. you're like, oh, by the way, you've got 7 days to live.
Yeah. Oh, we would definitely get caught in that situation. Oh my God. You sort of stuck me in that situation for Christmas and my birthday. Kind of. I mean, I would have thought I was in that situation. Dawn got me a very mysterious present. Anyway, but
it's the box. Don't look in there. You won't eat.
What? The box?
Yeah, the short story about the box. Never mind. Don't matter.
Oh, yeah. Oh, right, right.
No, which is funny because it actually was a box that I got, Jen, but we can talk about that later.
We'll talk about that later. It was a mysterious crate nailed shut that I received from China. And I was like, what the fuck is this?
Was it a Mogwai? Was it a Mogwai?
No. Oh, that would have been awesome. No. But it was very unexpected and terrifying. I still don't know the answer yet. We'll talk about it later. Okay. So,
but yes, watching Martyrs.
Yeah.
First impressions.
Well, I remember I watched it with you. And I remember the first time I watched it, it didn't affect me the same way that Inside did. It wasn't as visceral as Inside. Inside just like fucked me up, man. And I love that movie. It really messed me up. But this one, it got me. It did. But not as much as Inside, and I don't know why.
This one got me more than Inside.
Yeah, I don't know why this one got me not as much, but it does. I mean, it gets me. It's
fucked. It's really messed up.
And it's so weird because this movie is very much, it's got this weird internal philosophy going on, especially in that last half.
It does.
That is just so fascinating and screwed up to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also the thing about it that I love about Martyrs so much is just, like you were saying, is how unexpected it is and how it unfolds like an onion. The story just like, you go on, as a viewer, you go on the most insane roller coaster ride of emotions of not knowing what the fuck is going on and whose side you're on and who's good and who's bad. Like, from minute one. I remember when we watched that the first time and we're sitting there and she just comes in and destroys this poor family. And you're like, what the fuck did she just? And then I remember thinking at the time before the reveal, obviously before the reveal at the end, but I remember thinking at the time, like, this is really fucked up, but what a unique premise. For like this girl had messed up, you know, went through some horrible torture thing, but then kills the wrong family and then has to live with, like, how fucked up is that? Jesus. Like, I thought that was like messed up.
Yeah.
And then they fucking lay that twist on you when she's talking on the phone with her mother. Damn plank falls down. And she finds the torture chamber and you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, the movie plays like an exercise in escalation.
Yes!
Like every time it changes modes, it adds a layer of heartbreak. It's like, you know, even the most, you know, naive person gets jaded over time over like shocks and horror. Mm-hmm. But this kind of, every time you think, okay, I think I've got my bearings, they're just like, no, you don't. And it's got so many surprises. But that, I guess in essence, the home invasion scene is so startling that I don't know. It's kind of heartbreaking to watch Lucy, like, have to, you know, her inner struggle is very outer. That she is so conflicted. And we talked about earlier the portrayal of child murder, as it would be. And in this case, we are tortured right along with her at every turn. Like, she's, you know, she doesn't want to have to make any of these decisions. Mm-hmm. Well, I take it back. The kids she doesn't want to have done. The parents she's pretty aggressively.
Yeah.
Like, she's satisfied.
You don't feel bad about that.
Yeah.
And it's so nicely contrasted with the opening of the movie, because the opening of the movie is shown through, I love the movie reel of the video of Lucy as a child shown through the clinical lens of the photography in the movie that they're sort of showing, that show Lucy's sort of evolution from the almost feral child that she was when she was brought in, having been tortured and having been abused. And you see her sort of unfold, and you see her starting to make friends with Anna, and you see all of that, and you see that this is a girl who's slowly coming into herself. Mm-hmm. And then the next time you see her, she's got a fucking shotgun in her hand and she's shooting people.
Yeah.
Because you think she's gotten better, and then you see her just like take it out on this family who at the time you think is totally innocent and normal.
Right.
And you're just like, oh, I guess she didn't have her shit together. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess at this point we've seen her witness the feral woman. Mm-hmm. Who's been, you know, haunting her. And at the time, we certainly don't know that she's kind of crippled by the survivor's guilt, and this woman is a manifestation of that.
No, but we know something's wrong because we saw the sort of the flashback to the home that she and Anna were in, where you see that she was cutting herself.
Yeah.
And she was saying it was someone else.
Right.
So you sort of, the hint that there's a certain amount of disassociation that's going on with Lucy, but you don't think that it's to the extreme that we see in the house where she is being attacked by her own psyche.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, she's being attacked by
that girl, but it's her psyche. Yeah, of course.
But yeah, and you bring up survivor's guilt, which is a really great, which is really, it's one of the, it's a really interesting way to depict that.
That fucking Lucy moment, man, that rips me apart every time. Like when we start seeing, of course, we get that flashback and we see her leaving and seeing that girl on her way back and leaving her there. Like, oh my God. Oh.
And that's when everything makes sense.
Exactly. Like what's everything makes sense. Right.
Because I was even watching the movie, because again, going in completely blind, I was like, oh, is this actually physically something? Because it's so well filmed that it's really writing that line between, yes, there is something, there is a ghost or something that's haunting her, and or it's in her own mind. And they don't confirm that until you see that flashback to when she was a little girl and you recognize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, yeah, speaking to the way it's shot, even when we find out that Lucy is out of her mind, the way they shoot her tangling with and running away from, you know, this creature woman, it's still shocking. It's still thrilling the whole time. You're still kind of in the same sort of thrilled terror from before when you thought this woman was physical.
Right. That chase in the yard is an excellent chase.
Yeah. And even worse is seeing it from Anna's perspective, because Anna, of course, doesn't see the other person.
Right.
And you realize that this is something that Anna has probably seen pieces and parts of over the years because they've been friends for so long. But you get the impression that this is the first time that Anna's seen like the full-blown meltdown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of something that I might be getting ahead of myself as far as like talking about theory or whatever. But the fact that Anna was called into this situation, I feel like is the reason why this whole thing worked. You know what I mean? Because they were never intending on making Anna their target. She wasn't who they were trying to get after.
Sure. Right. No, that is why it works, because she's the only one who's selfless of them. The others are like put into that position. She puts herself into that position. That's why then she can withstand, again, jumping ahead, but withstand the flaying and everything.
And it's why it's so important. And if we don't talk about it later, that's fine. But it's why it's so important that towards the end, she has that conversation. She's replaying a conversation in her head between herself and Lucy about how not to feel fear.
Yeah.
And you don't feel fear by letting go of yourself.
Yeah.
And that's why that becomes such an important conversation later.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you get that weird... The only thing in the movie that I have that I think is just a weird choice personally, even though I get it, I just don't know if it works for me, even though I totally get it and I don't think it's bad. But in that moment when she's getting all zen, basically, and they start playing that inspirational music.
The plinky piano
The
music.
Plinky piano for torture. That's literally sweet.
That's literally what I wrote. I was like, it's what's with the plinky piano music?
I think I just wrote inspirational, like, bad music. It
feels like your childhood flashback.
Very like innocent and like learn, like somebody's learning something. Like that's what that'd be like. Someone's learning an important life lesson about their virginity. Like that's the music that was used for that scene, and it's just a little weird. It's a very special episode.
And Jen just touched on something that I think is really important, at least for me in watching this movie. No sexual violence.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Even when, you know, the main guy, the bald guy, is beating the shit out of her, it's a creepy business-like demeanor that he's got, and that he doesn't seem to be enjoying any of this. It's
he
not
could be a lady
fetishistic
just the
thrill.
Same. Yeah.
Yeah.
In my notes, but like to the listener, when watching Martyrs, do ride that volume level, because there is a lot of screaming in this movie, and you're going to have a weird relationship with your neighbors if you don't ride the volume. There's so much screaming.
There's a lot. That's why I was saying when I rewatched it in French, I barely missed anything. It's so much screaming.
This movie is 65% screaming.
Yeah. This one, I'll be honest, it's not my favorite thing.
You prefer high tension?
I prefer high tension. Yeah, I do, because The things that you guys love about it, the twists and the turns and the keep changing the story that keeps happening in Martyrs, is what I don't like about it. I don't like the existential kind of shenanigans and the cult. And if it was just some guys took some girls and then this girl's going to avenge them, I don't know. To me, that was fine enough. And then it's just more things and more things. And it's like the kitchen sink to me. And just everything jumps in.
I understand that's kitchen sink dilemma because I tend to dislike things like that as well. But I feel like this was so smart and thought out and where it wanted to go that it worked because it was so absurd.
Definitely,
it almost made sense.
And I do love the ending. I absolutely love the ending because I love an ending like that. That's my jam. But I just like there was too many like, and then this happened, and then this is gonna happen.
I did
that
go
was
back,
too much for me.
Yeah, no, I did get that feeling that at some point in the brainstorming for this story, they're just like, and then what if this?
Right.
And then no one's gonna see that coming. And there was like there's that at every turn.
It was I think for me because it was ultra violent, ultra loud, and you know what I'm saying. There was so much audio, so much violence, and I oh my god, some of that gore I loved. I'm not gonna lie, oh my god, I can't even deal with the fact that I was eating lunch and watching that today. But and things I'd never seen before as far as gore goes, and I loved that. But then it was just like now there's a cult, and now there's gonna be an existential crisis. It's too much for me.
I like that. I thought that's like, where it became beautiful when they
agree.
I can see both sides of it because it is very much split into like the first two thirds and the last third.
Right.
And that they're almost two completely separate movies. And I think that's what gave that sort of emotional cognitive whiplash that you have is going to be where you either come down on, okay, I'm totally on board, or like Mindy, no, that kind of wasn't necessary to what was, you know, in the beginning, a really great revenge. Are they, aren't they guilty type thing.
Right. You know, there was a lot of times, though, I thought, like, this is beautiful, and I did love especially the violence brought on by the cult members to Anna, you know, and I did love those scenes, but I don't know. Like, it was just too much for me. It was too much of everything. It's like when but it's a very French thing to be so much, because when you go to a Cirque show, it's like shit happening all around you all the time, music and dancing and flips and shit. So it's like, I don't know, to me it was just a little too much of everything for me.
You know, I had mentioned earlier that this is probably the clearest example of sort of French Extremities trying to take internal turmoil and external and to express it externally, because what is this if not a manifestation of a desire to know what comes next?
Right.
Totally. You know, I think there's always
like,
that.
It's like the fear of death writ large.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And if you had unlimited money and unlimited resources, how would you figure out what happens in the next world? Like, it's just, I think one of the reasons it works for me is because it's such a weird little philosophical nugget that they're picking at.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they've come to it, like the idea of martyrdom and the pictures of all the people that were in suffering and everything, and the fact that that's what they pulled onto.
Yeah.
As this is how we're going to figure out what life after death is. This is how we're going to peek behind the curtain, so to speak. And it's just such an interesting little philosophical nut that you don't see often. Like, you really do not see that particular philosophical idea explored at all in cinema.
Yeah. Yeah, no, very. And that's what I really appreciate about it as well. I find it to be really intriguing. And I also, I love how the end is open to interpretation as far as, like, why the woman kills herself.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I wanted to ask everybody what they thought.
The turban tortured terror.
Turbaned woman.
Mademoiselle. Mademoiselle. It's just so fascinating because, you know, you see that she's gotten to the point, they've literally skinned her alive, and oh my God, That is a really hard scene to listen to in headphones because it gets really squishy.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, it does. But I love it. I mean, yeah, that's where I start to pick it back up where I'm like, oh, I'm liking what's going on again in the film. It, like, the fact that she achieves this, like, next level consciousness, next level being from this extreme pain and it's not just the torture, I think, of these films. It really is the focus of the pain rather than the torture aspect.
They talk about that in comparison with, it's on the IMDb trivia page, but I have a really hard time.
I was going to say, they call it the anti-hostile, don't they, in interviews?
Yeah, but I think the filmmaker, well, at least IMDb has him quoted as saying that Hostile was like an inspiration for this movie. And like I said earlier, that when torture porn is often the result of a movie like this being made terribly.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think it's in the book. It's in Films of New French Extremity where they do talk about that pain dynamic. It is more about that.
Than the torture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so I wanted to share a theory that it serves as a metaphor for the class system that happens in wealthy countries, where the rich exploit and make use of the poor. Women and children suffering is certainly par for the course. And non-blue bloods would have to offer something truly incredible just to be treated like a human being. And in another way, it's as if the rich don't even like doing their own dying anymore.
It's right. Like, and I'll just now I remember what I was saying.
That jogged your memory.
Okay.
Obviously. And that's pretty much what I was talking about, what I was going to say, is that's what I really like about this movie, as far as the correlations they're making to that. As far as class and society is concerned, and as far as the torture is, you know, the pain that they're having to go through and everything that they're suffering, so the higher class people don't have to, in a weird roundabout way. And also, I love that what makes this different from Hostel and other torture porn varietals is that there's a real justification for the torture beyond the pleasure of these fucked up people just liking to watch someone suffer. Like, I love...
Because they make a point to show that they're not enjoying it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's the task. It's a job. It's a, you know, whatever. They feel they are burdened with this, if you will. So I love that. I love that they justified the pain. And usually I hate that, because usually what's terrifying is when you don't know.
Right.
There's no, you don't need to know. It's just awful. That person's just awful. That's why.
And the whole thing is explained to you straight out from the beginning when the very first meeting that Anna has with Mademoiselle.
Right.
And she's showing her the pictures and she's saying that this is the state that we're looking for. This is the sort of extreme suffering. And, you know, she goes so far as to apologize to Anna for what she's about to go through. But she said, I think, something to the effect that her suffering was going to be for the greater good of the world or something like that.
Il se trouve que les femmes sont plus sensibles à la transfiguration. Les femmes jeunes. C'est comme ça, mademoiselle.
And that's a scary justification you start making that sort of mental arithmetic of how many poor, unfortunate souls do we have to put through this process. And you find out that, I think when the guy at the end, he's announcing to the cult about what's happened with Anna, is that they've had four get to the final stage. Mm-hmm. Anna's the only one who's actually been able to say anything.
And that's what I wanted. That's what I was curious as to what you guys think, because I know what I think about the woman who shot herself and as to why. But I'm curious as to what other people.
Let's all go around and say what we think Anna said to the woman, and then why Mademoiselle put a gun in her mouth, and also what her words meant. So I'll jump first. I can only hope that what Anna said to her was that, yes, there is a heaven, and there is no way in hell that you're going to get there. And your people have corrupted any decent concept behind this, and you're all going to suffer for eternity for it. And I know, because I've seen. I get caught up. Mademoiselle's expression before she kills herself is one of like shame and maybe guilt, I thought. And so I thought, that doesn't really jive with the idea that Anna has told her that they're doing everything horribly, of course, and they're all going to suffer the consequences. Because like, if that is what Anna had said to her, she'd sort of go out to the crowd and say, I'm shutting down the program. This is all horrible. We're monsters. Right. Everyone go home.
Right.
And never do this again. So yeah, I don't know. I'm torn. I don't know. Mindy,
what I you? Thought I wished if like it was like an American film, Anna would be like, fuck you. And that would be how that would go. But like, I think it's
for 2.5 hours, like they described it. She was in that ethereal plane for 2.5 hours. And she's just like, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you.
But no, I think it's nothingness. I think it's nothing. And so I think when you see Mademoiselle's face, it's, I didn't exactly read guilt, but rather just like loss.
Yeah, like it was all for nothing.
Yeah. And so that's really how I took it. So Mademoiselle, in my opinion, says there's nothing and I'd be done with this now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Jen?
See, and mine's kind of like yours, Mindy, basically. Mm-hmm. It's very similar. It's almost the same, except in that I have no idea what she told her. But something about her expression at the end when she goes to kill herself.
Etienne?
Mademoiselle?
Sauriez-vous imaginer ce qu'il y a après la mort?
Ça va, mademoiselle?
Sauriez-vous?
Non, mademoiselle, je...
Doutez, Etienne.
I have this feeling that it almost feels like a look of superiority.
Yeah,
and
I
like
see that.
She's taking that to her grave. Like, she's the only one who gets to know. Like, and she can die now because she knows what's ahead of her.
Mm-hmm.
Because she just found out. But she's not going to share it with everyone because she's an asshole. There's something about her face. I don't know why, but I feel like there's just like either she told her something and like it's like what you said, Darren, and like it's she's going to hell and she's going to burn and whatever. And so she decides, well, fuck it. I'm going to go to my fate. I know what's happening to me. These fuckers don't know. Ha ha. Like, I don't know. There's something about the look. Because I just rewatched it this afternoon. And that look on her face, you're right. Like, there's something there. And I don't know. There's a little bit of like, I wonder if she did it as like a fuck you. You don't deserve to know what's ahead of you because of what we did. Or I don't know. I don't know.
Dog. I think, yeah, I try not to think about it too much because it would keep me up at night. but if I had to pin down an idea, I would think that Anna would say something to her to the effect that, yes, there is something out there, but you will never be allowed to see it. Like her specifically, that woman would never be allowed to see it. But would always know that there is something there, which is why I think she says keep doubting before she shoots herself.
Mm-hmm.
In the fact that, you know, yes, we've all confirmed that there is something there, but, you know, she says keep doubting because she knows that she's not going to be allowed to know what it is. And so she really has nothing to tell the rest of the group. She's got a big fat nothing. She knows that there's something there. She has built this up and she is, you know, stuck between this rock and this hard place that she now knows that, yes, for sure, there is something out there, but I don't know what it is, and I can't tell these people, and they're going to want to know, and they're going to be angry at me if I don't have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like,
right?
You know, if you're Moses coming down the mountain with the Ten Commandments, those Ten Commandments better cover everything, because otherwise everybody's going to be like, well, where's the rest of it? You know?
Yeah.
And she's faced with an impossible choice because she's not going, there's nothing she's going to be able to say. And maybe Anna did tell her exactly what it is, but the nature of what Anna was means it can be spoken once and it can never be spoken again.
Right.
And so there's
a way
that from one person to another and say, you know, I've told you this is what it is, but this will never leave. This is for you.
Yeah.
And this is going to be your hell. And this is going to be your torture to know that you have come so close and yet you will never cross that finish line.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's a great note to go out on.
Now we're all happy.
Yeah. Like, there's no way to talk about these and like feel good after, right?
Yeah, but it's one of the elements that makes these like necessary viewing,
mm-hmm.
that they are that challenging. They are going to leave people talking long after they see them. So on that note, everyone, let's all find each other on social media. Jen, Dawn, please plug the podcast. And I know you've got your Patreon up and going, and you should definitely talk about that.
Yeah, so you can reach us. Our podcast is, of course, Women in Caskets. We've got our website, womenincaskets.com. We do have our Patreon up. We are starting actually in the process of doing monthly, fully produced podcasts that are going to be exclusive to the Patreon feed, right, along with a couple other bonus things that we're going to be doing for all of that. You can reach us on our social media at Women in Caskets, or you can reach me personally, Dawn. I'm at Dawn Puppet.
And I'm at the_JenBrown. And yeah, we've got some really great episodes planned out for the rest of this year, or most of this year. We've planned most of the spring and summer and whatnot already. And we got some real fun ones. I'm particularly excited, even though we haven't recorded it. It is confirmed, so I can announce it. We're going to be talking with Anna Beiler about The Love Witch.
Ooh.
Really soon. So that's like, I can't wait for that, because that was my favorite movie of the year. And I just, as soon as we saw it, I was like, we need to talk to her. We need to talk to this woman.
Nice.
So that's going to be great. I'm sure of it. And aside from that, there's a bunch of other really good things planned too, but I figured I would just, you know, one little teaser future.
So starting in February, also we'll be moving to a bi-weekly schedule as opposed to just twice a month.
Oh, nice. Great.
So that's our other big thing. And you know, we're on hiatus right now in January, but come February we'll be back in the saddle again.
Yeah, with lots of new great content. That Love Witch episode should come out in February, as well as we also have my friend of mine, Lila Sturges, is going to guest with us, who is a comic writer for Jack of Fables and a few other awesome things. So we've got some really cool people. We're excited about you guys inspired us. We need to have more people on the podcast. More guests. So we're guesting it up for our to start off our 2017 in this awful climate. I feel like an awful liar every time I open my mouth and sound happy nowadays. Like,
horrible.
Yeah. After the election, my ability to watch a horror movie was pretty fucked up.
It took me a couple weeks. Like, I really didn't want to watch anything, to be honest. Yeah.
Well, they've always been my escape. So luckily that didn't get ruined for me. Because I've always been able to disassociate horror movies from the actual horrible things that are going on in the world for whatever reason. And they've always helped me deal with them more. So I will say I feel lucky that has not been ruined for me. If anything, it has helped. I will tell you, The Love Witch made me feel better about life after Trump's presidency. Because we saw it like 2 days after he won, right,
mm-hmm.
Don? And it was exactly what we needed. Like, it made me feel so much better. And I think it was because it was just okay. movies like this are getting made. This got made. All right. Like, it just, I don't know. It makes me feel better in times of crisis.
Great.
Personally. And we get real awkward and silent. Okay. Thanks, guys. Really validated my feelings there.
Just left you hanging.
Okay,
bearing my soul.
It's okay. I told you about in the bedroom. It's okay. Like, it's okay.
Jen and Dawn, thank you so much again for joining us for another marathon episode. We are on all the social media. We're also on Patreon and iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play Music.
All the things.
So find us, get in touch. Let us know what you, the listener, think about these pretty scandalous, controversial movies. I think everybody's got a pretty, we said it earlier that it gets boos and it gets like cheers and people talking about it incessantly, but there isn't really a lot of middle ground on these films. So this is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks. Assalamu alaikum. Gage grave la pêche. Faut que je me taille un week-end à Casa en passant par Marrakech. Car en France, c'est grave la dèche. On cherche tous à faire de la moula. Faut que je me bouge de BVS. Donc avec moi, je ramène mon gabouna. Je suis toujours à la furebeu. Je suis toujours dans la queue. Depuis que t'as entendu mon débit bizarre, mon gars, vas-tu ne jacques plus. Je prends toujours parti pour mes potes. Mais là, mon gars, t'abuse. À chaque nouveau couplet, je les chope comme mon gars va MOH la ruse. Mehdi Benatia, dealer tous les je m'amène à la S-Rom, ils aimeraient tous rapper comme moi, donc jusqu'en cabine ils m'espionnent. Si t'arrêtes de rapper, en vrai c'est un mal pour un bien. Les rappeurs sont comme les chanteurs de zouk, toujours à chialer pour un rien. Hein, Siana c'est Khatar, je veux la maille du Qatar. Si tu veux graille, arrive à l'heure, sinon on prendra ta part. Mes Arbi sont tous al cette année, j'ai en tout graille, histoire de finir mes jours dans une villa à Dubaï. Cette année je vais être mort tout comme le drapeau algérien. Mon son c'est de la frappe comme le pilon marocain. Les rappeurs je les ai piqués comme du piment tunisien.